Leeway. Okay. All right, so welcome everybody to the summer school lunchtime lecture on sexual violence in and African military conflicts, the lethal common denominator. It's a very serious and quite a topic which I think we all feel very strongly about, and we're looking forward to having Dr. Clark talk to us about this. I'm very happy to welcome Yaliwe Clark today, summer school,
and
I'm going to tell you a bit about her background. She is a lecturer here in the African Gender Institute, and her research specializations are on gender violence in African military conflicts and looking particularly at women's rights organizations and work around peace building. Ms. Clark was born and educated in Zambia, where she attended the University of Zambia and getting a degree in development studies before she went on to an MPhil in peace and conflict transformation at the University of Tromsø in Norway. Since 1996, Ms. Clark has worked in development contexts in Africa. For 10 years, she worked in Zambia, working with a development consulting business, later on with NGOs such as the Zambian Association for Research and Development, the Zambian Civic Education Association, the Women's Legal Research Project, and the Southern African Conflict Prevention Network. She's also been involved in the International Peace Academy's research project around NGOs that are trying to build networks around peace.
I forgot about that.
Oh, you see. Since she's moved to South Africa, she's worked quite extensively with the Center for Conflict Resolution, doing quite a bit of training work, I believe, around capacity building of people doing peace work in Africa, which I think we all can see is really important long-term work. And since 2005, she's been a senior produce officer. She's been a lecturer in African Gender Institute. So you moved from CCI to UCT. Well, both of them UCT units. One's in conflict resolution, the other one's in gender studies. And she lectures here, supervises theses, and conducts research. So we're very pleased that she made time for us. She's preparing for her courses beginning very soon, in a few weeks' time.
Yeah.
So thanks very much, Yaliwe, to come and talk about this really important topic. And
thank you.
Over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Janet. I was telling Janet that actually, when I was working at the Center for Conflict Resolution, I spent the last few months of my time there writing up a proposal to run our conflict resolution cohort of courses as part of the UCT summer school. But then I resigned. And nothing came of it. But maybe I'll go poke my friends that are still there and maybe we can start that conversation. Would people be interested in doing conflict resolution peace building courses? More practical work rather than theory and talking. Would that be interesting, or just want to get a sense? Because we didn't know who comes to the UCT school, or actually had it in mind in terms of who we could get to the UCT school, in terms of all the requests we got from governments and NGOs across the continent. We thought we could host it here. But anyways, that's an aside. Could you put that down? It's distracting. So thanks, Janet, for that introduction. It kind of reminded me of some of the things that I have been getting up to. Sounds a hell of a lot, but it's
does.
Not so much. It's not so much. So when I wrote the kind of couple of sentences on this lecture, when I was asked by the UCT Summer School, this is what I wrote. And I guess some of you have come with that expectation, and I hope so. You know, but looking back on it now, you know, I probably wouldn't have titled it Sexual Violence in African Military Conflicts. Indeed, I will talk about that, and I'm going to zero in on Uganda as a militarized military context. And yes, indeed, sexual violence, which is a common denominator in all military conflicts across the world. In fact, it's such a common denominator that it need not be a military conflict for there to be sexual violence, as we all know. So what I am going to do is focus on the work of ISIS Wike, which is a Ugandan-based organization that I'm now on the board of, but wasn't in my initial interaction with them. And what they've been doing over the last 13, 15 years is documenting the experiences of African women who have experienced armed conflicts. And their very first documentation process started with where their office was located, which is Uganda. So it's an international organization, but their office started in Uganda, and their offices across the world, but the Africa office started in Uganda. So my suggestion to you is that we start with some visuals we start with some conversations from the context that I would be working with in order to make my feminist critique of peace and security some key points. So really what this is kind of, you know, I find it difficult to talk about ideas without grounding them in a place, space, time, identities, and situations. So Uganda is providing that for us, but there are certain things I'm going to say about feminist theory and thinking that, of course, can expand, you know, beyond the Ugandan context, and I'll make that clear when I'm making those points. Not to say that we can generalize Uganda's experience to the rest of the world. I'm very cautious about that. Good, so we'll start with about 12 minutes. I just want to get to a certain point in the documentary, which is about half an hour long, but we can't watch all of it. We'll get to the 12th minute, and then we'll start the conversation, the conversation, which I will lead and bring in my thinking and my knowledge. Sorry to cut that sentence. So the film goes on to talk about different kinds of atrocities, some more statistics, some more legal analysis, and a little bit more about the work of ISIS Wiki, which includes setting up medical camps, gynecological medical camps, run by nobody else but ISIS Wiki, and sometimes volunteer doctors, and sometimes underfunded money. We have funding to pay. We had a recent big funding from what is called the MDG3 Fund, which we ran a huge camp in Liberia. Can you hear me?
You're about to hear very well.
Is there no sound system here? So I was saying that the film goes on to talk about legal, medical responses to these stories, more stories of this and more legal and medical responses, and also some of the work of ISIS Wiki in terms of actually providing medical interventions, gynecological interventions, that they source funding for themselves, not coming from the government of Uganda. And the biggest one that we got recently was from the MDG3 Fund, in which a huge medical intervention was done in Liberia. Quite a few have been done in Uganda, so ISIS Wiki has started working in other war-torn countries where this, for example, in Liberia, there was one gynecologist in the whole country after the war, 14 years of war, and he was the minister of something or the other. So they flew in gynecologists and health practitioners that we have begun to train along the way, who actually don't know enough about the work in order to do what these camps do, into Liberia. And there's literature on that as well. So I just, before I go into my own analysis and points, I'm always, always eager to hear what's on your mind. One or two points, and I think I will stop at three. Yeah.
I'm wondering, what about safeguards?
Yes.
We have it here in our country.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough, but there are safe places where you can go and hide. And that doesn't exist as...
It does, they're there.
Oh, they are there?
They are, domestic violence shelters.
Okay.
But in a war-torn situation, it's difficult to set up that safe house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To run it, there is no infrastructure. Yes. So it's easy to run a safe house when there's a building, when there's a community center, when there's investment, and then you build this structure. In a war-torn situation, that thing will be burnt out tomorrow. So you can see the strategy was running into the bush. That was the safe house. Until the level of armed conflict went down enough for them camps to be set up. Yes.
My name is Willie.
Yes.
I'm worried about that. The soldier and the policeman, they cannot do what they want to do. Like in South Africa. South Africa, the policemen, if they do rape or what, there is ICD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can report there.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And also the soldier in South Africa, there is an office. Mm-hmm. If we do a crime, you must report.
Yes.
There. But I don't see there in that field.
Yes. You remember about, that there was that story.
About other countries. In other countries, I can see in Uganda, on African countries.
Yeah.
The soldier, the policeman, he do what he want to do.
Mm.
You see, there's no punishment.
Yeah.
You see, here in South Africa, there is a punishment. If the policeman is do something or the soldier,
yeah,
go to jail. But I don't see there in the policeman, they report a crime or they take the policeman to the jail.
It's not easy to take a police officer or a military officer to the police or to courts. Just like in South Africa, Uganda has the same legal framework in which, you know, as a police officer, as a military person, you are not supposed to be committing those crimes. You saw that story, I don't know if you remember that story of the woman who was raped by a soldier, a government soldier. When he fell asleep, she carried her kids and she ran. And then she went for the gun, because that was evidence, and she took it to the police and reported the matter. The guy was picked up and arrested and so on. A few months later, he was back, he was even promoted. And then that lawyer came and analyzed it. So what I'm just trying to say is there are difficulties in the legal process and in the practicality of ensuring that, especially in governments that are run by military regimes, such as in Uganda, where the current government came into power initially through a coup d'etat, and you know, afterwards through a couple of elections, the most recent one, I think, last year, the year before last. So, you know, but Museveni, Yoweri Museveni himself, is a militia guy. He's a military man.
Yes.
The military and his cabinet are like this. You know, it's difficult to make the distinction between the military and, you know, structures of the state. So I guess that's a difficulty in situations of armed conflict where, in fact, it's militia groups and military structures that run what we assume will be a situation of providing justice. So I'm going to stop you there, because I know that there's a lot more people want to say, and you already spoke, and I promise to give one more hand. Yes?
The bulls that they're fighting there, are there some nasty trouble?
In Uganda, there are about 7 major ethnic groups. Linguistically, you can divide them into many more. Of course, the analysis, one analysis of conflict, of African conflicts in particular, which I find rather unfortunate, is that it's about ethnic violence, you know, or about, in South Africa's case, racial conflict only. But we know that when we really want to understand the depth of a conflict, we've got to look at the history of not only ethnic diversity and cohesion and conflict, but also it's a history of oppression. Now, whether that oppression happened along ethnic lines is something we need to understand. Ethnic diversity in and of itself is not a reason to say Uganda is more likely to go to war. But yes, in Uganda we can say, and there is a lot of analysis on this, that the war in the north of Uganda currently raging now is being raised by people of northern descent, north part of Uganda, who are quite different ethnically, geographically, from the south. So Joseph Kony, who heads the current Lord's Resistance Army, is a Choli. The people who run the government of Uganda, by and large, are not a Choli. But I cannot convincingly tell you that that is the reason why the war is raging. It is the history that brought us to the point in which people from the north do not have or sense or have been ostracized and so on in a way that created militia groups in the north. But Yoweri Museveni, who is not a Choli, the Nada, and some people say he's actually Rwandese, you know, came in through armed conflict. Yoweri Museveni?
Is the conflict getting less?
Okay. Well, the conflict in the north of Uganda is ongoing currently. It has spread across to the borders of DRC. It's across the border of South Sudan. There is a link between the militia groups in South Sudan and the militia groups in the north of Uganda. A peace process in the north of Uganda cannot shift until we engage with militia groups in Sudan, and some are in Kenya now. In terms of Joseph Kony, the head of the Lord's Resistance Army, right now he's at large in DRC. People suspect, but even though there was indictment out by the International Criminal Court in October 2005. So the war is still on in certain parts of the country, but you can go to Kampala and you'll never notice it. Right. So I'm going to close the discussion here. I wish I had an afternoon or a day with you to go through a lot more detail and context. So without getting too stuck in the context, but the context is enough for us to have a discussion about what is a feminist approach to peace and security. What does it entail? Now, there have been quite a few feminists who start from the very premise that you began. You began, and I think your question was?
I was going to say.
Pardon?
Safe houses.
Safe houses, yes. So there's that angle and there's that angle. Let me start with your angle. Feminist analysis will argue that the problem here in terms of dealing with armed conflict is the way in which mainstream thinkers, be they political scientists, historians, anthropologists, possibly, we'll be friendly with anthropologists, feminists are. The problem is that we look to the state to solve the problem. And feminists are very aware that the state in and of itself is one of the major reasons why we have the kind of sexual violence we have in society today. The state, whether it's in the form of the person who is the soldier, or the state as a structure that defines citizenship so narrowly that if you happen to be born and gendered as a woman, you will discover that the state starts policing your dress, when you get married, what is morality, and all those things. And the state is still catching up with legislation in order to recognize gender-based violence such as marital rape, rape in and of itself, you know, all sorts of things. So the first feminist analysis, and an African feminist who does this very well, is Amina Mama. And she argues that, and she used to teach at the African Gender Institute just before I came. She argues that, in fact, the problem is the state in and of itself is not only a militarized state, otherwise it would not call it that. Which state exists without a standing army and self-imposed area, and they have to do it consciously. And that standing army is not only militarized, but it's a kind of militarization that is part and parcel of a certain kind of masculinity, a militarized masculinity that has evolved from the colonial time in the African continent through currently. In the case of Uganda, we can see those words that were a bit difficult to see, that their militarized masculinity in the pre-colonial period, we still need to understand. I didn't do that research for this presentation. But starting from the 1800s, when the British colonial history began, that their combinations of governance systems, but the major British colonial governance system was first through, you know, a military kind of structure and arrangement. And what they did is those things meshed and merged with local militarized masculinities. And some feminists will argue, well, then we can push that argument to militarized femininities. So these feminists will say that the problem, the root of sexual violence is embedded in these gendered identities that, in order for me to be a man, I enact violence. Whether it's from the extreme of being a soldier, or it's the other extreme of being a husband who is dissatisfied. Those are all militarized masculinities, and they are violence. Other feminists will say, through this state system and history of colonization and so on, we also have embedded in society militarized femininities, the extreme, seemingly peaceful one, subservient wife or woman or girl at home, you know, limited and constrained, or the other militarized extreme one in which you get, you know, she's heading also her own militia group. And Uganda has one. Alice Lankwena founded the 1986 Alice Lankwena. She's a Choli. She founded the in resisting Yoweri Museveni's coup d'etat in 1986. She formed the Holy Spirit Movement. Alice Auma is her real name, and she was named Alice Lankwena because she believed that she had a spirit talking through her, and she combined military tactics with ritual practice. This movement splintered, as militia groups do, based in the north of Uganda, mainly amongst the Acholi, evolved into what is now the Lord's Resistance Army. when she fled to Kenya, I think she's still there, but her father took over, and then her cousin took over. Joseph Kony is her cousin. There's a lot to understand about the way in which violence evolved, the combination of these kinds of gendered, militarized identities. So that's one feminist argument, right? That therefore the conventional way of thinking about a peace process, you know, and counting how many wars we have, doesn't deal with the structural, violent, militarized identities embedded in peace and wartime. Because you're counting the wars, you're counting the armed conflict, but, you know, it manifests in other ways too. So, for example, this is a typical kind of way of counting wars that political scientists and historians would do. Number of conflicts, I got this from the United States International Peace website, USIP, and you can get a summary of all the conflicts in the world there, and all these academics, you know, writing about the conflicts. So number of conflicts by level, all types, and this figure says, so blue is what they call intrastate conflicts, and they are armed conflicts. That's what another thing that feminists would say, but what conflict are you talking about? But in political science, when they say conflicts, usually and war studies, history, it's armed conflicts. Intrastate and extrastate, which they link to the colonial period, which would be relevant for the African context. So what they are saying is, since 1946 to 2003, I know the text is small, so I'll read it. Since World War II, the number of interstate wars has remained relatively low. Colonial extrastate wars had disappeared by the mid-70s, but civil intrastate conflicts rose steadily until 1992, after which they declined steeply. This is a very typical way of doing an analysis of security, peace and security in the world, yeah? Feminists would deconstruct this on many levels. First of all, we cannot rely on the categories of the state in order to capture what's going on in terms of violence. That woman who is being raped by the state soldier, the militia group, her own husband, and all that, we cannot, where do we fit that? Intrastate conflict? Is that going to capture what it is we're trying to unpack here? Those safe houses, you know, how are they going to evolve? Yes?
I was thinking the United Nations troops are often the,
yes,
yes. Peacemakers.
Yes, so in the eastern of DRC, we know that there was a case last year in which how many hundreds of women were raped by rebel groups, and that's their strategy, you know, to intimidate the population. Just 15 kilometers from the Monuc base,
yeah,
the UN base. We also know that the UN has engaged in a number of reports. We even have a UN special rapporteur who is hosted here at UCT. UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, you know she's here? You know her name? Oh, okay. I should have put her picture next time. So anyway, the UN has done a lot of things, and one of the things that they really have gotten to own, and really they're trying to work on it, but the legal limitations and international politics is really not on their side. UN officials engage in sexual violence within their troops and with the local population in exchange for food. So, you know, you loaf of bread and then these women, you know, and so have, you know, transactional sex and violence and all that, let alone their inability to respond to a mass rape just 15 kilometers away from their base, which is huge. The base in DRC is one of the largest UN base, UN peacekeeping missions in the world, with up to 17,000 UN peacekeepers. Probably growing instead of shrinking. So that is the first point I want to make. You know, this kind of trends analysis of war and peace, you know, a feminist would really not be able to work within this way of thinking. What would we rather do? We would probably, and there are a lot of feminists, I just brought some books because I know, you know, you guys are buying books, so if you want to see what the book actually looks like, just go find it quickly if it's up there in the bookstores on the next floor. So, you know, you have people who are analyzing Cynthia Colburn, I don't have her book here. You know, she's worked with peace activists and feminists, and what they do is actually a deconstruction further of looking at gendered constructions of violence and their various manifestations. But from my research interest is also gendered constructions of peace, and not stay stuck in analyzing the violence and the militarization, but move on to, so what are the alternative ways of thinking and being? What is a gendered identity that's not militarized? How do we know that this is not a militarized identity, given that most of our identities, because of the state system, are probably very rigid, and we other, and we, you know, as we sit in this room, you know, there's a lot of violence going on around us and within our homes, and it's difficult for us to engage with it because we're in a militarized society. We're already stuck. It is the norm. Such of a norm, we can't see it sometimes. And when we see it, we're stuck. That, for me, is an indication that there's a lot for us to understand and think beyond the usual. There's another set of feminists, and I think I'll put Isis Wicke in that group, who would spend time trying to look at bodies. What happens to bodies that are exposed to violence? How do we get over the pain? How do we heal? All these medical interventions that Isis Wicke has been involved in have not been located. The mainstream health system either doesn't have them or doesn't know how to do them. How many of us can afford to go to a gynecologist, even when we have time? And when we have money, we budget. And if you don't budget to see a gynecologist, then you're very lucky. So there's the issue of trauma, stigma, pain, and the way in which our gendered identities of femininity, because we are the ones who seem to be more sort of the receivers because of the way our bodies, some people will say, bodies are made up, that there's a lot of women's organizations, peace-building organizations, that focus on that kind of work. Safe houses, and then we move on to legal clinics, women's legal clinics, rape crisis.
And I think of the mental trauma.
Yes.
The lingering behind the, not just the rape, it's what...
Yes. So even these conversations that Isis Wicke had with the women, the process of the research was a healing, it came to be a healing space. And they began to learn a lot about trauma healing, and they stopped only dealing with gynecologists. Now we deal directly with mental health practitioners, hand in hand with the gynecologists. They work side by side. In hospitals, they don't do that. They don't do that. So the other thing I wanted to say, which shouldn't skip my mind, is we can't underestimate, we can't ignore the work that feminists are doing on the legal front of understanding peace and security. Because there's a whole load of feminists across the continent and the world that will rely on the law, as you're saying, to stop the violence, to change behavior, to shift ways of being that are violent, you know, gendered violently. So we know that across the continent, so many laws are being pushed. Now, in the case of Uganda, let's move to the women's movement. Let's go after Idi Amin. Oh, I thought you asked a question about Idi Amin. Have you heard of Idi Amin before?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Museveni, I mean. Okay, so, you know, during Milton Obote, let's just look chronologically. This is another thing peace and security people do a lot. Timelines. What happened, when, to who, and why? But we're not historians. So Idi Amin came in 1971, and he took over via a coup d'etat over Milton Obote. Milton Obote was the first prime minister after the British, you know, after independence. But he worked hand in hand with the Kabaka. Kabaka is a word that you would use for ruler of a kingdom. I don't want to use the word kingdom because it assumes that it's a man, kingdom. But Kabaka, right? So Kabaka, Mutesa II, made an alliance with Milton Obote. Milton Obote is from the north of Uganda. Mutesa II and the Buganda kingdom that signed the contracts with the British in 1900 is more in the south. All those, you remember the map, that part where there was no fighting, most of that in the south is what was then areas of the Buganda Kingdom. So the Buganda people of the Buganda Kingdom benefited from the benefits of colonial administrative structures, and they used their governance system combined with the British governance system to extend their protectorate role to the rest of Uganda. So it required for independence to be possible for somebody from the north to ally with the Buganda. The people from the north were very mistrust, they didn't trust the Buganda, because Baganda Kingdom, people of the Baganda, because they felt that they had sold their governance and their freedom to the British by signing this agreement in 1900. So anyways, Obote, Milton Obote, of course, did that strategically just in order to, let me just go to that period. Yes, Obote. He did that really strategically because he knew the British would not let Uganda go unless the Baganda Kingdom were part of the new governance. Because the British had a partnership with the Baganda Kingdom from the 1900s. So Milton formed that alliance with Kabaka Yeka, sorry, as head of the coalition, not Kabaka Mutesa. And now what Obote did is once independence was gained, 1966, he stopped the coalition, and with the help of the army, he separated from the Baganda, the rulers of the Baganda Kingdom, and the Kabaka Yeka. And that, now he relied on one key commander in the army, Idi Amin. That is how Idi Amin then took over, and with a coup d'etat in 1971. So my point being is, during the time of Idi Amin and aspects of Obote's regime, Obote came back after Idi Amin when Tanzania invaded and squashed the Idi Amin government, and then very restricted time for everybody. So women's fight, you know, women, the women's rights movement that we now know in Uganda, the reason why, you know, they're ahead of the game in some of the legal stuff on gender violence, ahead of South Africa, before South Africa they had better laws, was because in after Idi Amin's time, there was more flexibility to then form various kinds of organizations. And I just want to show you, when Museveni came in, you know, the women's involvement was huge. From 86 onwards, there's Alice Lakwena forming her resistance movements up in the north. There's thousands of organizations being strengthened and new ones being formed in the rest of the country, even some in the north. I mean, if you think of the YWCA in Uganda, it's the largest in the world. They've got 1.5 million paying members and a staff of 1,000 in Uganda. So you can imagine the expansiveness of this women's movement, and you can imagine the issues they started tackling and dealing with. Whether there was intrastate conflict or not, they dealt with marriage, land issues, and so many things. And the things that they're taking on now are the things that people are being arrested for in Uganda. They're taking on the issue of homophobia, together with the LGBTI movement. One of the strongest academic feminists, Sylvia Tamale, she stands up. She's the one who's been facing head-on-head Bahati, the member of parliament, who pushed that bill that was proposing to criminalize same-sex relationships, and anyone else, anyone who knew of it. So it's one of those very dynamic women's rights movements, and it's from there you get this kind of, you know, for the Ugandan context, a legal analysis of the alternatives to violence and how to quash sexual and gender-based violence.
Okay, I think I'm talking so much, so I'm going to stop. Yes, I'm going to stop.
Could you help us with some information as to the incidence of this sort of conflict in other parts of the world? There's confrontation, interstate wars and so forth in South America, in Southeast Asia, and a number of other areas of the world. Is this sort of incidence unique to Africa?
No, not unique to Africa. So if we go to the one, I don't know about the conflicts in the places that we've talked about, but let's go to Serbia. Let's talk about Germany. You know, you can't say there was no rape there. You can't say that there was no plundering of civilians there. You can't say there was no equivalent of what we call genocide in Rwanda in Germany. It's another word we use. So if we look at conflicts, armed conflicts across the world, of course the weapons differ and their technology differs.
But the question of sexual violence is present.
So the incidence isn't unique to Africa?
No. Sexual violence is not unique. It's not unique to Europe. But it's unfortunate that the literature tends to pitch it that way, you know, kind of exoticize it. You know, look what's happening with these barbaric, you know, natives in Africa. It's almost got a colonial edge to it, you know. Barbaric natives, still primitive, need to be civilized kind of thing. But let's look at the conflict. There's one guy, Eric Hobsbawm, Age of Extremes. He's going to map for you the conflicts in Europe. Age of Extremes. Horrific stuff went on in Europe. So, I mean, if we want to then take that story and then take this one and then compare periods and contexts and say, you know, Africa's very different. Of course, all context will be different in some way or the other. So the things that happen in Uganda are peculiar to the Ugandan history, are peculiar to the context in which they happen and the timing and the situations. It's peculiar, the kinds of violence in northern Uganda are peculiar to the kinds of violence used by the colonial British government that were used to pacify and to control, you know, those people who are not in agreement with the British colonial system. That those violences were also learnt. So what we call now a standing army in Africa wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for the colonial standing armies that taught the current standing armies. You see what I mean? You can also have that analysis. So if we want to say violence is peculiar to a certain area, we've got to map it not only from its physicality, Africa, that space, but the international links as well. And violence is learnt, just like peace is learnt.
You know, in the American army,
yeah. There's
violence, internal violence against the women who serve in the army.
Yes.
And that's in all, I think, in all armies.
Yeah.
All military forces.
Yeah. Cynthia Enloe, who also is a feminist who writes on militarization and feminist analysis of militaries and militarized societies that are militarized, she and Amina Mama and another author, I forget her name, they will argue that the military wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for the existence of a certain masculinity. That was my first point. So just as the armies need guns and bullets, they need men who accept that their identity is violent. Yeah. Otherwise, you don't conscript to the army if you can't imagine shooting somebody. And if there isn't a link between manhood and courage and bravery and conscription of the army, it wouldn't be possible. The army wouldn't have people. Cynthia Colburn would say, actually, it also wouldn't be possible for the army to have people if these boys who conscribe are not supported by family members, mothers and sisters included. And Cynthia Enloe would call that, and I would call that militarized femininity. That has a peaceful axis in the sense that I'm not holding the gun, but I'm condoning that way of being it as a way of solving problems, institutionally, in the States.
It's
an economic livelihood. Or in the case of South Africa, it's either that or prison during the SADF.
Don't you think, what you're saying is true. But
yeah. I see you back there. I'll come to you.
Wars are normally started and led by leaders who are sort of middle-aged men, politicians and other kind of leaders.
Mm.
They need all these young men to go and fight.
Yes.
And to die.
Yes.
And to kill.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about, this militarization and masculinity, that's part of the sort of brainwashing process that you have to impose on your troops in order to get them to go out there.
Yes.
And part of that, always, I think, nearly always, is to dehumanize the enemy.
Exactly.
And that means the enemy women are also dehumanized.
Yes. So that you can rank
sort of fair game. And so on. Those things to me are...
And that dehumanization is a gender, it has a gendered connotation to them. Because why is it that women are dehumanized in a way that they encourage to rape the women?
Well,
rape a boy. But it's not always, it's not as common as... No. I'm agreeing with you that the kind of dehumanization we can do at gender is an analysis of that.
It's linked to the gender aspect, as you say, but it's also the whole of the enemy are dehumanized.
Yes.
And men as well.
Yes, across ethnic, across gender, dehumanized, whatever the reason is for the material aspects of the conflict.
But it's just
for the
conflict
visible aspects of the conflict. Pardon?
It's the conflict that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a war,
so the Geneva, I saw the hand there, I'll talk about the Geneva Conventions and, you know, what is a nice way of fighting. Sexually harassed and so on. These are educated children, and they come and they don't know what to do.
But then you can educate them on how to help them.
But here there's an infrastructure for them to go to. I send them to Rape Crisis. I send them to the wellness center and all that. But in a warm context.
You can tell them where to go.
Yes.
They're in the middle of nowhere. They don't know how to start. They've got nobody to ask. A lot of the time.
Yeah. I guess so. But in the modern context, we've got nobody to ask a lot of time. Mm-hmm. So I just don't like that. Like, you're formal, educated, you're sorted. You know, I just don't like those categories. You see what I mean?
What I mean is there's nobody to ask.
There is a lot of people to ask in those contexts. So if you take the time and you listen to the stories that they tell and how they cope and how they avoided rage and how they treated their illnesses, they do have places to go. So it's not like there's nothing, but there is something. And formal education is not enough. And
no,
you know what I mean? I just want to break that by constantly, formal educated, they're sorted. And then, you know what I mean? Yeah, so I just want to be naughty and just say, yes, but, Yeah.
Sorry, on each side of me, I've had people agreeing with what I wanted to say.
Yes.
Which is that it's prevention of this issue. We're talking about a sort of all the pick up the pieces strategy.
Yeah.
And perhaps we must also look back. I mean, obviously we've got to pick up pieces now.
Yes.
But we must look forwards.
Yeah.
To look back to see what led to those attitudes, mm-hmm. and look forward to see what can we do that will change the attitudes throughout society.
Yes, that's why there's a group of feminists that spend a lot of time doing ethnographic studies and anthropology.
And it's not militaristic feminization.
To find out. No, it's not. There's a lot of femininities that are not militarized. That's what I'm interested in. But there isn't much writing on that. When you link peace and security and feminism, you end up with a lot of stuff at the moment dealing with militarization and anthropology and critique of it. And then there's this growing feminist movement that's looking at the word peace and those gendered identities that are useful. But that is still coming up, and they're found in anthropological studies, they're found in peace-building work, and it's about, now we know this, what do we need to do to shift those things? Yeah. And the women's movement does awareness raising like crazy. That's the, like all, almost all NGO, women's rights NGOs do that. That's their first point of call, and then some move into the legal technicalities, some shift into medical provision and so on because the state is not functioning. So I agree with you. Two. So we're done, thank you very much.
You want to see some of the books?